Salman, I know that I am speaking not just for myself, but for a lot of people here when I say it is so good to see you again. And thank you so much for giving me some time to talk to you about your new book.
No, it's great to be with you, I mean, for more than the usual reasons.
Yeah. It's a fascinating read, this book. And I wondered where the best place to start the conversation was. And I wondered whether it might be good to sort of begin with you at that moment of sort of waking up. You describe this slightly groggy state you were in, hallucinating a very sort of apposite thing as a writer, which was these sort of structures made out of letters of the alphabet. Could you tell us a little bit more about that experience?
I mean, very, very literary hallucinations. And I kind of liked them. They were very beautiful, large, and detailed. But the closer I looked at these edifices, I could see that the building blocks were all alphabets. And then at another point, there would just be, when I wasn't actually seeing this, the complete hallucination, I would sometimes just see letters floating in the air, random letters, And I remember saying at the point at which I could say something when they after they removed the ventilator, I remember saying to Eliza and her siblings who were there, I said, "Why have you got letters on your clothing and on your faces?" And they said, "Well, no, we haven't." Mean, I think this is just a. I mean, I was on some major painkillers, morphine, fentanyl, all of that, this is what they produce, apparently. I was so disappointed when they took me off those. They don't want you to stay on those things for very long because they don't want you to become addicted, So that was really they only used those for the first couple of days, in the kind of most extreme moments, and then. They sort of weaned me off them onto more regular painkillers, and I was sad when the architecture disappeared.
As you say, you were on a ventilator, and I suppose people weren't quite sure the extent of your injuries or what, or I suppose what the impact of them would have been. And so your initial communication with people was through just your feet moving, is that right? And there was this concern that obviously the injury that you'd suffered to your eye might have meant that you'd had damage to your brain as well.
I mean, there was concern about, I mean, the reason for the ventilator was they weren't convinced that I could breathe by myself. And then, yeah, they would not, I mean, they until they had done a couple of brain scans, they were not certain whether I was fully in my right mind, And so I would be asked yes, no questions, and be asked to move my foot like once for yes and twice for no, And when I was able to do that, then people began to relax a tiny bit because it was clear that I was understanding, and able to communicate in that basic way. But I remember, I mean, when they took the ventilator out, the first thing I said, it was just such a kind of delight to be able to speak again. That the first thing I said was, "I can speak."
I suppose as well, as somebody whose craft is words, obviously the written word, but you're also a very eloquent man because I've spoken to you before, and it must have been incredibly frustrating to have all of those barriers to your communication.
I mean, it was frustrating, but I was also in, as I said, very, I was medicated up to here. And so I wasn't fully, acute and sharp in my thinking for those first few days. I mean, the doctors had said to Eliza, my wife, that the first couple of days would determine whether I would survive or not, so there was a those first 2 days, it was a real question mark. It wasn't by any means, even after this very long surgery, more than 8 hours. Even after that, it wasn't a given thing that I would survive. I was a little bit unaware of all of that.
Yeah.
But everybody else in the room was very aware of it. And I think what the key moment was when they felt able to take the ventilator out. Because then they thought, clearly they thought that I would be able to live without assistance.
Yeah.
And it was, in fact, okay. I mean, my breathing was all right. You know, and there weren't any further alarms in that department.
Yeah.
And so then by the third day, they seemed reasonably confident that I would make it, you know. And then it was weeks and weeks and weeks. So
as you say, Eliza was the one who had very clear sight, I suppose, of just how grave things were. And in fact, she wouldn't let you look at yourself in a mirror for quite some time.
Yeah, no, she made the nurses and all that take the mirrors out of the bathrooms and things like that.
Yeah.
So because, and I think she was wise, because when I finally did, because, you know, she had been taking photographs of me day by day.
Mm.
And so much later, once we were back home, she said, "Are you ready to see that stuff?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Yeah, okay, I think I'm ready to see that." And then she set up a little projector and showed me those first days. I was completely horrified.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean, I actually hadn't realized how bad I looked.
Yeah.
You know, and of course the nurses were all lying to me. You know, you're doing great. You're looking fine. You look much better than yesterday.
It's an important professional kind of lying.
Yes, it's completely untrue. I looked like shit. I mean, there's things that you can't see anymore, but here on my right side of my face, the knife had essentially cut my whole face open.
Yeah,
and it was like a chasm, you know, the two parts of it being held together by metal staples, with a gap in between, you know. And so it was incredibly shocking. It looked like a horror movie.
Yeah.
And I think she was quite right to protect me from that at my weakest moment, you know.
Yeah.
Because what she felt was that it would reduce my resolve to fight back. You know, it would be up so shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time I did look in a mirror, all that had changed, you know. So, I mean, the staples had been taken out of my face.
Yeah.
And the things had closed up. It was still, I mean, I still looked pretty awful.
Mm.
But I didn't look like that.
Let's talk a little about Eliza, if you don't mind, because this book, whilst it is about the attack that you suffered and your recovery, it is in many ways a book about love and about your relationship with Eliza and how important it was in the recovery. But you had a rather sort of, well, I would say dramatic or even comedic meeting when you first met her. Would you mind sharing that story?
Yeah, I mean, she really likes the story because it makes me look so ridiculous. but no, we were both at the same literary event, and we were both on the same like program, the opening night of the Penn World Voices Festival. And afterwards, there was an after party on the roof terrace of a nearby hotel, like 3 minutes walk away. And the roof terrace had a kind of inside part and then an outside part. And I had seen her obviously at the event, and then I saw her, ran into her again at this after party. And it was a beautiful evening, you know, warm, sunny. I mean, not, it was dark actually, but a warm summer evening. And I said, let's go out and look at the city at night, because it's, you know, New York City at night is kind of lovely.
Yeah.
She said, okay. And she walked out onto the roof terrace and I was following her. But what I didn't realize was that the sliding glass doors that separated the inside from the outside, her side of it was open. My side of it was closed, which yeah. I was too distracted to notice. And so I walked smashed into it. And with some force, and fell down. And my glasses kind of cut the bridge of my nose a little bit, so there's a bit of blood streaking down my nose. And panic, you know, people gathering around me going, you know, Salman Rushdie's fallen down. And all I'm saying to myself is, do not fucking faint. Do not pass out. And I didn't. I didn't. And I got to my feet. I was helped to my feet. I was feeling a combination of really embarrassed and a bit shaky. And I thought, okay, I should probably go home, you know, because A, this is just a very stupid thing to have done, and I feel stupid, but B, I also feel a bit wobbly.
Yeah.
So I said, look, I'm going to go and get a taxi home. And then, because she's a nice person, she said, I'll come down with you and make sure you're okay. So she came down with me to make sure I was okay getting in the cab. Then she got in the taxi.
And the rest is history.
The rest is, well, current affairs anyway. And that was, you know, I mean, we'd been together from that moment. That was May Day 2017.
Yeah.
So we'd been together for, you know, well over 5 years, very happily. And so we felt, both of us, that we were kind of in a love story. You know, that's the story we were in.
Yeah.
And then when this happened, it's as if somebody was trying to change the love story into a murder story.
Yeah.
And what we have been trying to do since then is to turn it back into a love story. So it's a love story with a murder story in the middle.
Yeah. It's just maybe not how you would have wanted to plot it out, but it's certainly effective.
Yeah, it works.
the relationship between the two of you is so important to your recovery. And I wondered whether, because when we think about what it takes to actually survive injuries like those that you had suffered, which were, you know, life-threatening injuries, it does require something very special to actually pull through that. It's not just a given. And it feels to me from reading the book that there are a couple of things. One is that love and support from Eliza.
Yeah.
And the other, in a way, is your writing and the kind of writing that you have done through your life. There's a fantastic section where you talk about, slightly in your delirium, but you're talking about this idea of having written books which aren't completely realist. Had you perhaps been building this bridge between the sort of the absolute facts of the world and something slightly more magical. Would you mind elaborating on that?
I mean, I'd like to think that that might be true. I mean, it's probably not true, you know, but you know, in my books, miracles happen.
Yeah.
You know? People levitate. People live for 247 years. People acquire telepathic powers, et cetera, et cetera. There's, you know, young women turn into feral monsters at night, and so on. You know, people fall out of an exploded airplane, fall like 30,000 feet down to a beach in Sussex and live.
Yeah.
And that kind of fight, get up and dust themselves down and they're okay.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that all my life. And it's as if that principle of magic somehow crossed the frontier from fiction into fact.
Yeah.
And came to my help. You know, I mean, if I was writing the story, I am writing the story, but that's in a way the story I would, if it was fiction, I would write that story about how all these things that I've made up, you know, turned into, as you say, a bridge, which helped something similar, some similar kind of unlikely thing to happen in real life.
There's also a fabulous moment in your recovery when you were visited by your agent, Andrew Wiley.
Yes.
And he is telling you to rest, obviously, and to recover. And he says that, you know, eventually you'll write about it. And you express some doubt about this idea. And he says, just very simply back to you, you will write about it. And that's because obviously you have this very long relationship and he knows that you would have to put pen to paper to make sense. I
mean, quite clearly, he that moment he knew me better than I knew myself. You know, and I mean, we're like an old married couple at this point. You know, I mean, when was it? He became my agent in, I think, 1986.
Yeah.
You know, so I remember that some years ago, I mean, like in 2016, we went out to have dinner to celebrate our 30th anniversary. And now that, I mean, that's already 8 years ago.
Yes.
So it, we've now, you know, we've been, it's longer than any of my marriages. And it, now it's gone way beyond him being my agent. I mean, he is my agent, but it's gone way beyond that. I mean, he's just one of my closest friends.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he knew what at that moment I didn't know. You know, and which I didn't know for some time after that.
Yeah.
Because there was probably about 6 months when the idea of sitting here, sitting at a desk and thinking about writing just was unthinkable. You know,
yeah.
Apart from anything else, I mean, the thing that took longest to come back, even after all the wounds had been healed, was physical strength.
Right.
I was just very weak, and would run out of steam quite early. I mean, I would get to like 6:30 in the evening, and I was kind of done.
Yeah.
And I had to go to bed. So I certainly didn't have the kind of energy required to write anything.
Mm.
And then it was just, again, I guess I've been doing this for 50 years, you know, so I have a lot of muscle memory for how you write books.
Yeah.
And there was just a moment when it was more or less like throwing a switch when the juice started flowing again. And I thought, okay, I think I can sit at the desk now.
Yeah.
And then I opened this, I have this computer file in which I keep scraps of ideas, you know, but what might be a story, what might be a next thing, etc. So just some of them are just a few lines, some of them are a couple of pages. They're just, I just keep them there to look at when I need to think of the next thing. And I opened that file and looked at this stuff, and I just thought, this is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I can't, this is silly, you know. If I try and write this kind of thing, people are going to say, what's he doing?
Mm.
And even, I never mind what people are going to say, I would think that I was kind of evading the subject, you know. And then I thought, well, okay, well, I'm from India where we have elephants, and there's an elephant in this room. An Indian elephant, not a great big African elephant, but an Indian elephant with smaller ears. And I thought, well, I can't ignore it. I have to do this first before I do anything else. And at that point, kind of another switch flipped in my head, and I thought, okay. And I suddenly started really wanting to do it. And the way I approached it was, in the first instance, I kind of wrote myself a letter, just a document of a, I don't know what it was, 13, 14 pages, something like that. Just telling myself what I thought I should be writing about, you know.
Right.
I mean, beyond the simple fact of the attack, you know, but beyond that, what am I writing about? You know, what's the book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to describe the attack, I mean, as I did, you could describe it in like 10 or 12 pages.
Yeah.
You know? So, but what's the book? And I asked myself that question and tried to answer that in this kind of conversation with myself. And in the end, that a version of that became a book proposal, mm-hmm. you know, which Andrew then used to talk to Random House and other people.
Mm.
And by the time I'd done that, I thought, okay, I kind of think I have a handle on it now, you know.
Yeah.
And then I started trying to write. And well, the first chapter in which the attack is described was very hard to write.
Right.
I mean, really quite emotionally upsetting to write.
Yeah.
And I was writing very, very little in a day. If I wrote 5 or 6 lines, you know, that would be about as much as I could do. But once I was past the first chapter, it sort of opened up, you know, and it gradually got easier and easier to write. And I was able to do more, you know, more in a day and get it done. So it Yeah, it started, but I mean, I think in a way it's kind of always the same for any book, that the first chapter is the hardest to write.
Right.
And I've always felt when you're writing a book that the first half, you know, when you're kind of pushing the boulder uphill, is harder than the second half when the boulder is rolling downhill. And, you know, it's always faster to write the second half of a book than the first half of a book.
Yeah.
Because if you've done it right, you've set things in motion and then they just have to unfold, you know. And that was true of this as well, with the exception of, I think it's chapter 6, which is the dialogue with the imaginary dialogue.
Yes.
I initially, that wasn't part of my thinking. I'd had this kind of notion that maybe I should try and get a meeting with him.
Yeah.
And then I read the story that I incorporate in the book about the knife attack on Samuel Beckett.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually went to the court when the guy was being tried and said to him, "Why do you do it?"
Mm.
You know, and all he got back was, "I don't know, sir, I'm sorry."
Right.
Well, no, that's no use. that doesn't get you anything.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if I was to meet my attacker, I would probably get some banality of that sort.
Right.
I mean, I doubt that I would get an apology because there's no indication that there's any remorse there.
Mm-hmm.
But I would get some cliche, you know, and it wouldn't help me, you know. And so then I thought, well, you know, you're a novelist and you're a person of the imagination.
Mm.
And so why don't you use your skill, which is imagination and storytelling, and try and imagine yourself into his head.
Mm.
And maybe you'll get further by doing that than you actually would by being in the room with him.
Mm.
And so then that got added into the book.
It's really interesting, as you say, that first bit being so difficult to write, obviously because of the trauma of what you had been through. And you speak as well about the fact that as you were going through your recovery, there was that post-traumatic stress that you were suffering because you had nightmares that would sort of plague you, sort of replaying events and things like that. So it's no surprise to me that sitting down to write about the attack would be so, so difficult. But there's a really interesting feeling through the book as you start to let go of the importance of your attacker.
Yes.
Partly, as you say, because of knowing that you wouldn't get any meaningful reply from them. Mm. And then I suppose the relief of then focusing on yourself and your recovery and your relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought that it was a book with three people in it, you know. Me and Eliza and him. And he, as you rightly say, during the course of the book, he becomes less and less important, you know, until by the end of the book, I actually don't care about him.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel. And one of the consequences of that is that I don't feel angry. You know, it's kind of surprises me that the emotion I'm not feeling and have not felt throughout this period is anger.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not even exactly sure why that is, but I'm just noticing that it is so. And by the end of the book, yes, it's because, as we've been saying, I kind of dismissed him from my head, you know. So he's kind of not worth being angry about.
Yeah. You know, is it possible that actually helped you to recover? Because of course anger is a very negative emotion, yeah. And that's not what you need when you're trying to recover physically.
I think exactly that, you know. I think certainly when I was in hospital for all those weeks, anger would have been an irrelevance, you know. I mean, what I was focusing on was recovery.
Yeah.
And that took the whole day, you know. I mean a hospital day begins at like 4 or 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
And goes on intensively through the day. And that's where my attention was, you know. And anger just would have felt like an intrusion into what mattered at that moment, you know. And by the time I got out of hospital and came back home, in a way it was too late to be angry.
Right.
I mean, too much time had passed. I'm not somebody who broods, you know.
Yeah.
I don't bottle things up and hold them. I let things go. And I think it's quite helpful to me, you know, not to be burdened in that way by anger.
When I, in the past, when I was an actor, I always used to have this fear, I suppose, that what would happen if I, you know, lost my voice permanently or whatever, if I couldn't do the thing that I wanted to do, what on earth would I do with my life? And I wondered whether in your recovery, whether you were ever worried that you wouldn't be able to write again, because obviously you were going through a lot of physiotherapy with your hand and then obviously with the loss of sight in one eye. How did you fight, I suppose, the despair of thinking, what if I can't be me?
Yeah, no, I mean, I did think that. I did ask myself that, you know, and it wasn't so much the physical injuries, you know. I mean, obviously, it's things are harder with one eye and one and a half hands. You know, it's harder to use a keyboard.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, now I find I was always somebody who liked to read real books, you know, books. And now I find I'm reading much more on an iPad.
Yeah.
Because A, it's illuminated, so that makes it easier. And B, I can adjust the size of the type. So I've suddenly entered the digital age, you know, thanks to this. But I used to love sitting with a book, you know, and I don't do that so much now. So I did worry. Yeah, I did worry about whether it was all kind of over in that respect.
How did you battle that? Because that, again, is that sort of despair or worry would be the kind of thing that could very easily drag you down and make that recovery that bit harder. Was it very much, again, the sort of support of people like Eliza and your family that kept your spirits up?
Yeah, I mean, I just was tried to focus on, you know, I tried not to think about that. You know, I just thought I had so much. I mean, there was a lot of work to do to recover. You know, there's an enormous amount of first of all, medical interventions, but also physical therapy and also psychological therapy. You know? And I mean, actually, the days were quite busy.
Yeah.
They were quite full. And so there really was, I didn't actually kind of have the time in the day, you know, to sit and think about work. It was just, that was just not a subject at that time.
Yeah.
And then, as I say, just suddenly came back. And I mean, I can actually almost remember the date, you know?
Yeah.
When I just said to myself, okay, go sit down. See what happens.
Yeah. There's a great engagement with your work throughout this book. Lines from your other books sort of occur to you as you sort of go through various experiences. And one of those is to be born again, sang Gabriel Fauresta, tumbling from the heavens, first you have to die. Mm-hmm. And you have obviously been through this experience, and it's an attack and a recovery that some people wouldn't have survived.
Yeah.
Does it feel like you are having a sort of second life? And if that is the case, does that mean you have sort of different goals or things that you want to do with it?
No, I do feel, you know, I'm not supposed to be here. I mean, the odds against it were very great.
Yeah.
I mean, I survived by the skin of my teeth, really, and by the intervention of great surgeons and et cetera.
Yeah.
But I mean, even the doctor, when I came off the helicopter at the trauma hospital in Erie, Pennsylvania, the doctors afterwards told me, they said, you know, when they brought you off the helicopter, we thought it was too late.
Mm.
You know, they really didn't think that it would be possible. And I believe I am what is technically known as a medical miracle.
Okay.
Because many of the doctors, these surgeons and experts, you know, including not just the surgeons in the hospital, but the specialists I had to go on seeing afterwards.
Mm.
They said, we never expected your recovery to be this quick and this thorough.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you see, my hand moves now.
Yeah.
And And the hand specialist said that when injuries are as serious as yours, we don't have this kind of optimistic prognosis.
Yeah.
And he said, actually, what's happened to your hand, he actually said, is a miracle.
Yeah.
So I exceeded all probability. Thank goodness. I do feel, I quoted that Raymond Carver poem, Gravy.
Yeah.
Where Ray Carver was told he had very short time to live. And then he lived 10 years.
Yeah.
And during those 10 years, he wrote some of his best stuff.
Yeah.
And he says in that poem how he feels that like every day is a blessing, that every day is gravy.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't supposed to have those days.
Yeah.
And I think that too. I think, I wake up in the morning and I think, still here.
Dispose well for your output over the coming years. If you could do a Raymond Carver and produce, some of your best work, then that's a very exciting prospect.
If I can. I mean, I'm just happy that I have some time to do a bit more work,
Yeah.
I think the answer to your question is about what happens in this second act.
Yeah.
Is you just value the days more, you just have a much more everyday experience of how good it is to be here.
Right.
And meanwhile, all around me, people of my generation are having the opposite experience.
Yeah.
And that's kind of horrible to see, and makes it even more, throws into even sharper relief the fact that I'm, that I'm still around. I mean, where are we, April? I mean, in June, I will be 77 years old, and 77 is the age my father was when he died.
Yeah.
And I think, for all of us, go beyond your father it's a moment.
Yeah.
I'm this is book number 22. I'm well aware that there's not going to be another 22. but at least I'm still here and I can still have a few more. That feels good every day. It feels, life is worth having.
And presumably, given the reasons or the supposed reasons behind this attack, but also I suppose the conditions that you've been living under for a lot of your adult life, does that mean that you feel even more keenly the importance of freedom of expression for artists?
Yeah,
and how does that sort of, I guess, how has that altered or has it not altered your relationship with a book like The Satanic Verses and the impact that that's had on your life?
No, I mean, one of the things I had was enjoying before the attack was that the Satanic Verses had gone back to being just a novel.
Right.
I mean, it was so long since the trouble.
Yeah.
That certainly for younger readers, I mean, the book came out in 1988. Mm-hmm. It's an old book. And so people discovering it now who anybody under 40, really.
Yeah.
Would have no real memory of that, and would just approach it like a novel, and some people loved it, some people didn't like it so much, and that's okay.
Yeah.
That's like the ordinary life of a book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was having finally that ordinary life, and I was really happy about that. And now I guess it's been dragged back into this other narrative.
Yeah.
I hope that won't last too long.
Fingers crossed.
Mm.
It's been such a pleasure and a privilege to speak to you, Salman. As I said, I think a lot of people seeing you would be surprised to know that you had gone through such a horrific ordeal, because you seem to be exactly the same man that I spoke to a few years ago about his work. Same spirit, same drive. And I guess a large part of that is to do with the fantastic support you had around you during your recovery. And as I say, in many ways, this book, whilst it is called Knife and is about that attack, it feels to me very strongly to be a book about love and your relationship with Eliza. And it's really illuminating on that respect as well.
Thank you. No, I mean, the reason I divided it into those two parts was, it's called, the first part is called The Angel of Death and the second part is called The Angel of Life.
Mm.
And it's the Angel of Life who stuck around.
Well, thank you for your time today, Salman. As I say, it's a real pleasure to speak to you, and obviously wish you all the best with your second life.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I'm glad we got it to work.